defined by claim is a definition of story, but it only applies to the three parks zone.
Right. So strictly speaking, it probably, given the three parks as a part of state, it probably actually isn't in there.
So in light of that, do you still think reference should be made in the rule to stories?
I think if we're going to continue referring to it, then it should be defined or explained through form of the bus zone.
Well, then the question is, should the word be removed or should a definition be added?
I would support removing the word stories and reverting to a height limit.
Could I just ask the question in a slightly different way from what you were saying? Is there a need for a distinction between the basic height limit and the articulated height limit? So I understood you to be saying three stories plus some area for articulated roof line. Is that in fact what you want the rule to say?
The height rule, I'm happy for that to remain in state 12 metres without the stories. The roof aspect side of it is...
So it's covered by 15.
I just would want to make sure that the roof allowance is provided for within that 12 metres rather than an additional bonus on top of that 12 metres.
Commissioner Munro and I are both struggling with is knowing that people will develop to the maximum permitted activity potential. 12 metres will allow development of a flat roof that exceeds three stories. Is that an outcome that you are happy to provide?
Yes, I think that's appropriate for the zone. And in terms of that height limit, which applies to flat sides, the recession planes will also control that roof form in terms of effects on neighbours and immunity and sunlight access and all those things. So the pure height limit is appropriate with someone.
Okay.
Maximizes that same thing. Puts in more than three stories.
Yeah. In terms of the restricted discretionary height between 12 and 15 metres, and there's the restrictions identified. What is it about height taller than 15 metres that leads you to an outright non-complying activity status? And I'm particularly thinking about the policies that explicitly contemplate bridges of height limits.
Through recommended changes, the policies around breaches would apply to anything that's non-compliant specifically. So if you're going above 15 metres, the breach would be breaching above 15 metres.
So normally I'd expect a non-compliant height rule to be justified by a policy that said limit height to X or limit the height of buildings to avoid effects on Y. It's unusual to see policies talking about we think height limits might be okay to be broken if these are taken care of, but then provide for as a non-compliant activity. That might be totally appropriate, but it just seems slightly misaligned, and I'm just trying to understand what it is that's special about height between 12 and 15 that can justify an RDA, that height above 15 can't. So are there any particular effects or concerns or policy problems?
In terms of the way that's, that policy's drafted and, with regard to limiting or allowing for more, the reasoning for that would be more aligning with the enabling as opposed to restrictive nature of the plan, and recognising that we don't have a lot of high-density zone land, and we can't say for every land parcel in that zone what may be appropriate or not. While trying to set limits, there may be a proposal on a site that could be designed well if over 15 metres, and that's the avenue that the policy is trying to target, that if you have a quality design that can address the effects, then that might be appropriate depending on the site and local context.
No, I understand that. My question is, why in your view is a non-complying activity status the right one to reflect that enabling policy, as opposed to at the extreme end, which I'm just putting as a point for discussion, unlimited height is a restricted discretionary activity with restrictions to high quality, all the things you've just said that should be achieved, etc., etc.?
So is your question whether it should be discretionary as opposed to non-compliant?
Well, that's one option. My question is, how do we go from an enabling policy framework to a non-compliant method? That seems to me to not line up. So what I'm asking you to do is either help me understand how they do line up, or if you agree they don't line up, recommend whether the policy should change to be less enabling or the method should change to be more enabling. Now, as I say, it might be totally... I'm just not, maybe not seeing the logic, so it's really an open-ended question for you to help me.
Yeah, I think I'd have to go and consider that.
Okay.
I can see that. I can see where you're coming from. I suppose it's aligned with significant changes that have been made through the heights to this point, and I think there might be some discussion through the hearing already about how activity services are used to encourage or discourage activities within the zone. So the non-complying has been applied to indicate that it's not the norm within the zone, I suppose, but that it can be appropriate depending on the circumstance.
Can I just throw into that mix when you're considering it, the effect of the recession plans? It seems to me that on flat sites, the 2.5 metres plus D, even getting up to 15 metres, you're going to have a 12.5 metre yard on three of the boundaries at least. But it seems rather large, which makes me wonder whether the even 15 metres is nugatory.
The modelling that we had done, although it comes with a lot of assumptions to it, did indicate that the recession plans have a large control on what is actually achievable on the site in terms of height and whether you go up to 15 metres, that final story may be very constrained and have a lot of space around it. I would imagine that if someone was, a developer was in that realm of 15 metre height, that possibly going to be breaching other standards and possibly breaching position plans to realize the development potential.
I think that sort of reinforces Commissioner Munro's question. If you get to that point and you breach it and you have those sorts of controls, why non-complying? What else is there to be concerned? That's perhaps what the real issue is.
Just one, then I'll put this up earlier in the day. You have in mind for a residential unit right at the end of that section, a statement there, talking about risks, hazards, and the extent to which such a risk can be avoided or sufficiently mitigated. We've got another in the low-density residential overlay, which does a straight ban on anything greater than, I think, 1,500 metres because of perceived ground instability. The two don't sort of match up. Here you're saying you can get suitably qualified people to confirm that there's no natural hazard there, then all right, you can do it. This other one's saying you can't do it full stop. And it's just a bit of conflict between high density residential and low density residential, because I believe they have a fairly good argument that it's not about whether it's zoned, it's about how you go and utilise the land within that zone.
Yes, that matter of discretion is applied throughout the plan, and it's something we're looking at amending so that it, and I believe we're providing a response to that in our write-up reply, to apply GMLA through the plan to address natural hazards. That circumstance that you're referring to, I believe you're referring to the Queenstown Heights overlay area.
Yes.
I'm not aware of the specific report details, but Amanda Leaf might be better placed to respond on that matter.
Do you recognise some inconsistency there between what you're saying for the two zones?
That specific area, I think, was subject to. Yeah, as I say, I'm not aware of the background, but I believe there's some specific studies that have been developed on that land that indicate that it is of significant risk, that potentially it should be looked at in a bit more detail before you allow intensification there, whereas these matters of discretion are intended to apply to areas which we don't have an understanding of, or to capture the fact that a site might be subject to hazard, and so we can look at that risk where new developments are proposed.
Because there seems to be some other areas, like the suggestion of shingle spikes, you know, Gorge Road coming off the hill to the south, that the Regional Council brought up in some discussion about what was happening up there. There seems to be one or two grey areas there. Make the commission, or don't have an appropriate may not occur, or how something can occur or cannot occur.
I'm going to start with a more general question. In the hearing stream one, we were told that the council's projections are that by 2031 there will be a population of 55,000 in the district. And that's another 22,500 people in 15 years. Just using a very generous household size of 2.4, that's 9,500 households. And given in this district 30% of all dwellings that get built are holiday homes, means that somewhere in the order of 13,500 dwellings need to be built in 15 years in the district. How many of those is this zone going to provide for?
I suppose we're trying to allow the zone to accommodate as much as it can, but recognising that practicalities of developers may mean they choose to do certain things to deliver a certain aspect of the market. But the zone is intended to provide for as much as it can. To an appropriate level. The NPS on urban development capacity, if and when it comes through and what form that has, will require us to look a lot more in detail about
the zones and the capacity. Might require it next year too.
What's that, sorry?
We might require it when we're looking at the map. Irrespective of the NPS.
Yes.
But I'm just wondering, I mean, and the reason I raise the question is because certainly in Queenstown, much of the area that's zoned high density residential seems to be full of visitor accommodation. And I'm just wondering whether these zone provisions actually really enable more residential development or visitor accommodation, even though visitor accommodation is being pulled from the stage. I'm talking about the reality, not what evil biases, what's in the
way. The location of the zone would lend itself to that use. I take that point that the zone may ultimately be occupied by visitor accommodation or houses used for holiday homes. This isn't a qualified statement, but I have seen a lot of that type of activity being pushed to more traditional residential environments. So whilst the zones may still provide for that aspect of the market, it may take it away from areas where we may want to see more residential housing or where it's better suited for residents to occupy those areas as opposed to visitors.
The other area that I'm interested in, differentiating this plan, this zone from the medium density residential, is the provision for commercial activities. It seems to me that objective 925 is less enabling than the equivalent objective in medium density zone. Is that intentional?
Thank you. And the reason behind that was that the high density zone has access to, its, by its location, has convenient access to commercial areas, and that, and so it's not necessary to support those types of activities as much as potentially the medium density zone, which is more separated and could benefit from having those access to services closer. But that's not to say we still recognise that in the high density zone some aspects of commercial development come with, for example, visitor accommodation, and there is some need to provide for that within an integrated development.
Are you familiar with to be honest, higher density areas overseas where the ground floor might be retail? Well, actually, even in New Zealand, I'm thinking of Mount Maunganui as an example, the ground floor could be retail, cafes, etc., and then above that is apartments. Is that not intended in this district?
That was the intention behind provisions in the medium density zone, and I have seen those types of environments and lived in them, and I think they're great in terms of activating the street, providing interest to the public environment, a number of benefits that come with them in terms of the high density zone. In Queenstown, there's potentially access constraints to some of the zone, and that it's steep and may not provide for people, not easily provide for those uses being easily walkable or bikeable or convenient to access. So that's one reason it hasn't been encouraged as much, as well as taking away from the town centres that that zone is integrating with, and the intention to for people to move in and enhance those areas. The medium density zone, conversely, is more isolated but can still benefit from those services and record.
Just in your summary, paragraph 7b. You talk about good design and outcomes and maintaining an alpine appearance. I'm just wondering where in the plan there is any policy about alpine appearance.
There isn't. That point is more just saying that the roof bonus seems to have been presented as a way to avoid the monopitch roofs, which presumably may not align with an alpine type of design, which is expected or might be expected for Queenstown. And my point was really just that gable roof may be appropriate in some cases, but monopitch can also work well back into the hillside, and there's some good examples of that as well. And it's not necessary to promote one or the other.
I think from memory, Mr. Williams' evidence suggests that there's some value in having pitch roofs in the zone. You don't think it's that important then? I think he's going so far as to say that we should be providing the rules to encourage it. Are you saying that we should just leave it to whatever the market prefers?
That would be my view. There's good and bad examples of both forms, and I'd be a little bit concerned about promoting one over the other without properly looking at that in terms of the design outcome. are seeking from the zone and unintentionally encouraging or incentivising that at the expense of avoiding some other forms which may contribute good urban design as well.
Just further down on the same page, you're talking about the NZTA issue of being involved in notifications. I asked Mr. McCollum the same question. Isn't the issue that NZTA should be considered an affected party in certain circumstances? Isn't that the sort of wording that really satisfies both your concerns and NZTA's?
Yes, I agree with that suggestion. I think that would be more appropriate, and I think Mr. McCollum supported your view. I also listened to your question to him about whether the NZTA is notified for development in the highway. And I also wonder whether the NZTA is more concerned with locations of access points as opposed to intensification of land which already has an access to the state highway. So his, Mr. McCall's response, I think, was that NZTA, nobody can do works within the highway without notifying the NZTA. So if one were to develop in the zone, the NZTA would, by virtue of that, if it was a new development and a new access point was needed, would be consulting on that basis, whereas that site was just intensifying, but it already had an existing access point then.
I think he also was concerned with the, while there may not be a change in the access point, there may be an increased number of dwellings getting access off the same access point, and that could have an effect on the state highway. So it was rather more than just increasing the number of access points as being the distinction, that, as I understood it, is. Distinction from the medium density residential in 958. The boundary setbacks 2 meters, the side and rear. And the medium density residential at 1.5. I'm just wondering if there's a particular reason for the greater setback in this zone. The recession plan deal with that, though?
The recession plan would, the flat sites ultimately control where the setbacks from those boundaries.
So it's really more a matter of slating sites. Does the is the intention that there not be buildings with common walls in this zone?
Yes, that would be the intention for the zone.
Sorry?
That would be the intention, that, right, that some buildings would have common walls.
They will have common walls, but then you have to have 4 metres between buildings.
The boundary setbacks would be from the site boundary itself.
Mm, but if two sites are adjoining, is there any reason why two buildings can't adjoin? If they design the buildings so that they don't need the external white things on those on that boundary, is that
could happen in that circumstance that liberation setbacks and you can see just by virtue of the site being comprised of multiple separate allotments.
Yeah, so they're looking at some of the flat areas, for instance, like between Helensland Street and Helensland Street and Stanley Street, they're quite small sites through there. And forgetting redevelopment of those, that's going to make discretionary activities of all those applications, isn't it?
The same would apply to other zones as well, though, and I guess under the operative plan, the same.
I'm not worried about the high density we're trying to see watered up with it.
I think if you could amalgamate lots and it was a simple thing to do, then that might be more preferable to addressing all the site breaches that come from separate land parcels, but I'm not sure if that's the solution.
Can you just help me with the Punamu site? As I understand it, it's a sloping site because the evidence, the earthworks have been done post subdivision, so we have to take the ground level beforehand. How do you see development occurring there in a way, how can I put it? Well, is it axiomatic that using the rules in this plan will lead to something which is of a scale and form that's inappropriate on that site, given the existing development around them?
The evidence presented indicates that it's a sloping site, and my initial view of that site was inaccurate on that matter, where I referred to recession plans.
I'm just wondering how you would see, given the sloping site rules, how would you see that site developing?
Well, given that it has been considered as a sloping site, then the lower height limits will actually apply to that site, being 7 metres. So the significant height limits are not a provider for under a consent framework if someone wanted to go to the 10 metres or beyond that, and notification to neighbours under the notification rules. So in terms of height, those existing apartment owners would likely be notified if someone was going beyond that 7 metre height limit. In terms of everything else, other rules applying to the site, I think they're probably appropriate for that scale of site.
The 2 metre setbacks would apply. Do those setbacks apply from the easement or not?
No, so they would just be from the boundaries.
Right.
So the easement...
They could build over the easement, possibly. I don't know the details of the easement.
I assume that the easement could be amended by the landowner if they desired to do that. But as it is at the moment, the location of that through the site provides some separation between the apartments to the rear and any development on the main component of that site in the centre of the site. And the irregular shape of that allotment at the sides is such that the design of the building is, while it's not a given, it lends itself to a design similar to what has been approved on site, and ultimately a landowner may choose to implement the existing consent for the site. We don't know that either, but I think the narrow edges of that allotment and the 2 metre setbacks at those locations adjoining the apartments is appropriate under the new rural framework without creating any bespoke rules for that site. Also recognising there's one more vacant lot in the northwestern corner, I believe, which is still undeveloped, and could also provide some of that mitigation as opposed to constraining the development of lot by solar.
Okay.
So just a small one. Line 4, 20. Outdoor storage. What is that?
Outdoor storage is defined in the plan. Land used for the purpose of storing vehicles, equipment, machinery, natural and processed products and waste outside of fully enclosed building materials in excess of 4 weeks in a year.
Yeah, I think the question is the same as we had for this leaf. Although I don't think in this zone firewood piles will be quite the same.
No, perhaps they won't have wood burning fires, but it might be easy.
Possibly not. I'm not sure what the previous question was. It was whether it was impactful.
The issue that we raised with this leaf was it's too broad. When it said bulk material storage,
it's changed to
that's fertilizer bins or something. That's quite different from any outdoor storage. And I wonder if that change actually has the consequence that you're intending.
Yeah,
or whether the notified version might actually be what you intend. You and Ms. Lee need to discuss that because it needs to be consistent between the zones. And it's the same with the waste management rule, which has been designed for Queenstown, but doesn't require many numbers of parts of the district. So they're not your fault, they're just things that I think they've been made consistent through the zones, but they just need to be corrected,
right.
If you like.
So we'll look at that in terms of our reply, clarifying what's intended there and what we think it should be to be consistent.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye, June, to 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.